Hello, I'm Neil McGregor, and this is Germany, Memories of a Nation, from BBC Radio 4. I'm in Kaliningrad, a Russian city on the Baltic coast. And although it may sound a bit surprising, this is a very good place to start an exploration of German history. But I'm finishing this sentence 1,000 miles to the west, in a French city, Strasbourg. Because, no less surprisingly, this is also an excellent place to start thinking about what it means to be German. Kaliningrad was for 700 years Königsberg, a great German city on the Baltic. This is the cradle of Prussia. Founded by the German Teutonic Knights in 1255, it was in Königsberg that the rulers of Brandenburg were crowned kings in Prussia. It was here in Königsberg that Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, spent his entire life. No history of German politics or philosophy can be told without this city. Equally, no history of German thought, action or achievement could properly be told without Strasbourg. Here, in an entirely German-speaking city, Gottfried von Strasbourg wrote his Tristan, the passionate masterpiece of German medieval literature which the world knows through Wagner. Strasbourg Cathedral is a supreme example of German Gothic architecture. And here in Strasbourg, Goethe, the quintessential German writer, first discovered what it meant to have a German culture. Today, Strasbourg is a French-speaking city, part of France. There is no other European country with so many of its great historical centres now outside its frontiers. But then the story of Germany is like no other in Europe. The borders of the Germany that we all know today are the borders of a state that was born when the Berlin Wall fell 25 years ago, the latest of many Germanies. Historically, Germany has always been a land of floating frontiers and shifting configurations. And that uncertainty about where your state begins and ends is, I think, for the island-dwelling British, hard to imagine and almost impossible to internalise. But it's been a central reality of German life for 1,000 years. But Germany also has a long history of internal frontiers. If in the 1770s a youngish Goethe had travelled from Strasbourg to visit Kant in Königsberg, he could, by a slightly circuitous route, have crossed about 50 separate German-speaking states, and each one of those would have its own distinct, disjointed history. Both Britain and France, with strong traditions of centralised power, can more or less credibly present their history as one single national story. For Germany, that is simply not possible. Bavaria and Saxony, Hamburg and Berlin all have radically different histories. But they do, however, have a large number of common memories, memories that all Germans share, of historical figures like Gutenberg or Bismarck, or of events like the Reformation or the catastrophic hyperinflation of the 1920s. Many of those memories are, of course, shared by the Swiss and the Austrians. But Switzerland's long neutrality has given it a profoundly different history. And Austria experienced neither the prolonged Cold War division of the state nor the painstaking public investigation of the crimes of the Nazi era. This series is about the memory of those who live in modern Germany and the role those memories still play today. There is, of course, one memory which dominates all others, the Holocaust. The systematic murder by the Nazi regime, with the connivance and complicity of many of its citizens, of millions of Jews in Germany and across Nazi-occupied Europe. The Holocaust Memorial, row upon row of grey rectangular blocks, sits at the heart of Berlin, a constant reminder to the German people, to the German government, and to visitors from around the world of an incomparable atrocity. Walking into it, moving among the blocks, you are quickly disoriented and overwhelmed. The scale of this monument, like the scale of the event it commemorates, is ungraspable. It cannot be measured, only acknowledged. Every aspect of German history has to be considered in the context of this event. Every memory we shall explore in these programmes stands in its shadow. This series doesn't attempt to be in any sense a narrative history of Germany, but it aims to explore through those common shared memories some of the formative strands in Germany's modern national identity. I shall try to do that through a number of buildings and a selection of objects, some big, some small, some grand, some surprisingly ordinary, but each one of them with a story to tell and a significant memory to reveal. And this, I think, is without question the best object to start with. It's the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. Six tall Doric columns supporting a rectangular platform on which the bronze figure of Victory rides towards us in a chariot drawn by four horses.
Es ist das nationale Monument.
Professor Monika Grüters, the German Federal Minister of Culture.
Es gibt kein anderes, was eine Konkurrenz dazu wäre. Es gibt ein einziges nationales Monument und das ist das Brandenburger Tor.
It is the national monument, she says. There is no other that can compete with it. There is only one national monument and that is the Brandenburg Gate.
Und zwar deshalb, weil es sowohl...
It is, of course, she goes on to say, the symbol of the Berlin Wall, of a world divided into East and West. And at the same time, it's the symbol of the fall of that wall and of liberty regained. It reminds us of the loss of freedom, but it is in itself also the great symbol of freedom regained. It is the national and the international monument of freedom and unity. Monika Grüters is talking about the meanings that all across the world have attached to the Brandenburg Gate since the wall fell 25 years ago. But the history of the gate goes back 10 times longer than that. It was built in the 1780s on the orders of the King of Prussia as a monument to peace. Sometime later, a bronze figure of Victory was placed on top, giving the gate the appearance of a triumphal arch. But the first person to use it as such was not German, but French. For this is an object through which history has passed again and again. It was here in 1806 that Napoleon, having humiliated the Prussian army at Jena, made his triumphal entry into Berlin. It was here in 1950 that the first major demonstration was held to protest against Soviet dominance in Eastern Europe, when the crowd pulled down the red flag that flew over the Brandenburg Gate and demanded free elections. And it was here on the 3rd of October 1990 that a million people gathered to celebrate the reunion of East and West Germany and the birth of a new state. But the catastrophes of the 20th century, Germany's defeat in the First World War, the collapse of its Weimar Republic, the murderous criminality of the Third Reich, and then the long division between East and West, have left a nation unable to construct a straightforward reading of its own history. German scholars have struggled in vain to piece the different parts of this jigsaw together, but none has been able convincingly to fit the great intellectual and moral achievements of 18th and 19th century Germany and the ethical abyss of the Nazis into one coherent pattern. This is in a profound sense a history broken, so damaged that it cannot be repaired, but rather must be constantly revisited, which is what objects like our neoclassical gateway in the centre of Berlin help us to do. The Brandenburg Gate is not just a place where history has happened. It's also a remarkable viewpoint from which to look at other moments of German history. If you turn west on a sunny day like today, you can see glinting on the top of its column the gilded figure of Victory. What it commemorates are the three great victories over Denmark, Austria and France, by which Bismarck unified Germany in 1871 and created the first modern German state. But you were never meant to look west from the Brandenburg Gate. It was built as the ceremonial entry into Berlin, and looking east down the Grand Avenue Unter den Linden, under the lime trees, you would see the very heart of the city, and at the end of the vista, the Schloss, the palace of the Hohenzollern kings. But you can't see it today.
It was demolished by the Russians in the 1950s as an unacceptable symbol of Prussian militarism. On the site of the Hohenzollern Palace, the East German government built their palace, the Palast der Republik. You can't see that either today, because it was demolished in a highly contested move after the reunification of 1990. In its stead, the Hohenzollern Palace today is being rebuilt to serve as a museum.
German history cannot stand still. The events of the 20th century simply will not allow it to. British history, with its steady, usually comforting narrative, is a far simpler affair. In Germany, the past has a more complex and far less reassuring relationship with the present and with the future.
Let me start by saying history is what should never happen again.
Michael Stürmer, distinguished political commentator and former advisor to Chancellor Helmut Kohl.
That was the leitmotif that suppressed the more positive aspects of the German past, which there are many. And history was taught in schools basically as the prelude to Nazism and the German dictatorship and the German catastrophe. And only since the 1980s, so almost four decades after the end of World War II, there was a more relaxed attitude and people dared to organize exhibitions and rewrite curricula where the other parts of German history, the German past, played a major role.
In those four decades or so, a conscious attempt has also been made to make public the most painful memories from the Nazi years, the supreme example being the Holocaust Memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe and the monuments to the other groups killed simply for being what they were, Roma, disabled, homosexual. I know of no other country in the world that at the heart of its national capital erects such prominent monuments to its own shame, or that reshapes older monuments damaged in war, not just to remember the past, but to ensure that the future be different. For me, the outstanding example of such a transformed, transforming monument is in Munich, the Siegestor, or the Victory Gate.
It was built in the 1840s to honour the heroic feats of the Bavarian army in the Great War of Liberation against Napoleon. On the top stands the bronze figure of Bavaria, in her chariot drawn by lions, facing proudly north. Below her is the inscription, "To the Bavarian Army." So far, so typical. You can find similar triumphal arches in almost every capital city in Europe. But what makes this arch so interesting is that the other side tells a quite different story. It was badly damaged in the Second World War, and the restoration makes no attempt to recover the classical details of the original. The upper part of this side of the arch is a blank expanse of stone, and at the bottom of this disconcertingly empty space are the words "Dem Sieg geweiht, vom Krieg zerstört, zum Frieden mahnend," dedicated to victory, destroyed by war, urging peace. This arch tells two stories, the causes of its making and the circumstances of its destruction. And it carries with it a moral message that the lessons of the past should be redirected towards the future.
For details of more programmes about Germany available on the BBC, or to see the buildings and objects featured in this series, search online for Germany, Memories of a Nation.